May it please the court, Nicole Swift, on behalf of appellant Emily Ektenkamp, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. I wanted to start off by first acknowledging that plaintiff's allegation in this case described conduct that is very troubling, highly inappropriate, unprofessional, and immoral. But whether that conduct was unethical or even violated statutes or rules is not the dispositive question in this appeal based on qualified immunity. The appropriate question is when the alleged conduct occurred, whether controlling federal precedent placed beyond debate that Ms. Ektenkamp's alleged conduct violated the Eighth Amendment, namely, whether it had been clearly established by controlling case law that sexually explicit communications, displaying sexual images, propositioning an inmate, and rubbing an unspecified part of an inmate's leg in a sexual manner without alleged contact with an intimate body part violated the Eighth Amendment. There's no clearly established...
I know I'm interrupting, but you just added a fact, I think. You said rubbing a leg without an intimate We don't know much about the leg rubbing, do we?
Well, what we have is only the fact that the leg was rubbed. There's been no allegation.
I don't know
that
if it was the upper inner thigh.
Or a groin area, for instance.
If I can just finish so we have a clear record. Not at all. I know you're trying to answer my question, but I'm just trying to avoid talking at the same time. So I think you just added something to your hypo. That's my only point. I think we don't know much about the touching. It was on the leg, and we don't know if it was the upper thigh or the upper inner thigh, and that might matter a lot for purposes of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Is that fair?
I agree that the area of the leg, yes, may matter, certainly, in this case, particularly with respect to stating the violation.
But we're not just talking about, and Judge Mossman was very clear on this, he didn't have a case that just involved what I'll call sexual harassment as opposed to potentially sexual assault because he had touching. That's the allegation in the complaint. And at this stage of the litigation, we assume that's true. There was touching.
That's correct. Okay. For purposes of at this stage of this procedural posture, yes, we do have to accept as true the allegations in the complaint, including that an unspecified part of that leg was rubbed in a sexual manner. That is correct.
So there's been no discovery.
That's correct. We have filed a motion to dismiss, and that is where we are on the procedural posture based off of qualified immunity, based off of the fact that qualified immunity is essentially immunity from suit and should be heard early in the case to avoid potential discovery if there is immunity.
This, it seems to me, the facts are very similar to the Vasquez v. County of Kern. Now, I recognize we have the Eighth Amendment versus the 14th Amendment, but basically, why doesn't that case plus the obvious situation that mental health counselor ought not be soliciting sexual conduct, touching, showing videos? Why doesn't that just resolve the qualified immunity question?
I'll start with the Vasquez case. And so, yes, the Vasquez case was raised by plaintiff. I do think it is extremely important and actually material to the clearly established analysis, the fact that it was a 14th Amendment case.
But it was a 14th Amendment case because it's a juvenile case, and we have this special status for juveniles of not being incarcerated per se. They're detained for rehabilitation and release later. So basically, we often look to Eighth Amendment precedent when we're looking at 14th Amendment rights. Why can't we do the same here?
Because for 14th Amendment cases, and this was actually stated in Vasquez, it applies a much more protective standard because it applies to pretrial detainees. And in that context, even they applied it to the juvenile ward. The 14th Amendment clause prohibits all punishment. That's different than the Eighth Amendment clause that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And there may be, again, clearly established precedent in the 14th Amendment context that does not apply in the Eighth Amendment.
But we have said very clearly, sexual assault, sexual conduct like this is not punishment. That is no part of punishment, right? So we're talking about conditions of confinement, and sometimes those are pretrial, and sometimes they're post-conviction. And we have, as Judge McEwen said, we have often looked at, when we're talking about conditions of confinement, we've looked between case law between the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And then we have, of course, our Sandoval case.
So I said, well, I suppose for, again, to answer the question about why is the Vasquez case not clearly established?
Well,
is that your...
seems to me, I didn't ask a good question, but I'm agreeing with you, and or I guess maybe just Judge McEwen that said that, you know, that's a very tough fact pattern for you. And I think your briefing says, well, but it's distinguishable because that's under the, you know, 14th and not under the 8th. And as I was just alluding to, you know, we had the Sandoval case, and to Judge McEwen's point, we have often looked to the 14th when looking at an Eighth Amendment case and vice versa. So I'm trying to figure out what your strongest argument is that your client wasn't on notice.
I would say, again, the strongest argument is the clearly established precedent has to be on that actual constitutional standard. And there's no question that there's...
Let me stop you there. Because we have a case in the Ninth Circuit, Schwenk versus Hartford. And basically, here's a quotation, which we have to deal with. Any sexual assault is objectively repugnant to the conscience of mankind and therefore is not de minimis for Eighth Amendment purposes. So here, construing the facts in favor of the plaintiff and the claim of a sexual assault, which is this touching, doesn't that resolve the question at this stage?
For purposes of qualified immunity, again, you have the two different prongs, one being, was there a violation in the first place? The second being the clearly established.
Right.
And on the first prong, again, we don't concede that there was a violation stated for the reasons stated in our briefing, but I think it's a much closer question. That's what we acknowledged on our motion to dismiss as well. But for qualified immunity, the plaintiff also must identify a case with that in which an official was in substantially similar circumstances and was actually held to have violated the Eighth Amendment, and that's what we don't have here. And the case law that you're citing to, the Schwenk case, as well as Bearchild and Wood, absolutely hold these propositions of law that sexual abuse and sexual harassment violate the Eighth Amendment. And we're not disputing those legal propositions and the fact that they were adopted. What we are arguing, though, and I think what was evident at oral argument, was the fact of where is this clear dividing line between what is an actionable Eighth Amendment violation mm-hmm. and constitutes sexual assault or harassment versus what does not. And what makes that, I think, particularly difficult to navigate is the fact that we don't just have Schwenk and Wood and Bearchild, and even if you are going to try to put Vasquez in there, although, again, we don't think it's applicable here, we have a number of other cases in which the Ninth Circuit has held that, for example, in Austin, an officer who exposed himself, who his intimate areas, to the prisoner for 30 to 40 seconds, that was actually held not to even constitute an Eighth Amendment violation.
Yeah, there's difficulty if you're talking about cases that's dated, because in the Eighth Amendment, we're always looking at evolving standards of decency, and we look at that. We're very careful about how we do that. So dated case law is problematic for you, and particularly problematic is case law that doesn't involve touching. Right, because Bearchild looked to the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and to the top of your argument, you acknowledge, which I appreciated. We don't know a lot about the touching that happened here, but Judge Mawson was very clear that he didn't have to consider whether your client was on notice if her conduct had been harassment without touching. So, given that we have touching in this case, the case that you're talking about, where an officer exposed himself. Is quite different.
We do have other cases in which we've cited, though, that do involve touching, like the Wattison versus Carter case. There, no Eighth Amendment violation was held, where an officer approached the prisoner while he was seated on the toilet and rubbed thigh to thigh.
Right.
You know, we also have the Bluford versus the Prunty case, where the official pulled the prisoner's hands towards the official's own genitals, grabbed his genitals, demanded anal sex. Again, no Eighth Amendment violation.
And all of those involve specific incidents. The problem that I see with this case is that there's a pattern over time involved with an adult. How old was Etchenkamp time?
Ektenkamp?
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact age, but I think somewhere around 30.
A mature adult?
A mature adult.
And how old was T.W.?
21.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But repeated acts, approaches, demands, if you will, in a custodial situation by someone whose job it is to counsel people out of bad behavior. And you think that's not clearly established.
And let me just add one other fact, is that this counselor was aware that T.W. had also been subjected to prior abuse at the hands of a mental health counselor, plus all of the facts that Judge Hawkins laid out.
Yes, we understand all of those facts and the troubling nature of those facts. And whereas I think they certainly could be considered in terms of this court deciding how to, again, apply that line, that dividing line between what is actionable and what is not, based off of the factual circumstances, that is what has not been clearly established. And Supreme Court precedent, including in Zorn versus Linton, continue to urge the courts, including federal court of appeals, that the question can't just be broadly defined as sexual abuse violates the Eighth Amendment. There actually has to be sufficiently similar fact patterns that apply that broad legal proposition. And what we don't have here is any case law, for example.
Hold on. We do. So I'm still trying to get the answer to the question about that Judge McEwen asked, which had to do with the Vasquez case. And I think your only answer there is it's not that it didn't involve the same kind of grooming behavior, extended fact pattern that Judge Hawkins is describing. In fact, it's spot on. But your answer there, I think, is confined to the difference in the pleading, whether it was pled as an Eighth Amendment claim versus a 14th Amendment claim.
That's correct.
Okay. So then can you grapple with the question I think a couple of us have asked about our case law where we have looked to the 14th Amendment on an Eighth Amendment claim and vice versa? What about that? Because the question is whether your client was on notice, not whether she's a lawyer who knows which amendment she may be violating.
Well, in terms of, again, defining this constitutional violation, like the standards are different. So whereas I think for looking at the 14th.
Different, but I'm trying to figure out, but we have recognized that in this other case law, and we've looked back and forth to figure out where the line is in terms of the conduct. Because the question is whether we can say that the official, in this case, you know, the defendant, your client, was fairly on notice. And that's what we're grappling with.
How was she not
on notice?
So again, I think the question of how is this not wrong, or how is this not obvious, as the plaintiff raised in their brief, I think that goes back to, again, the other prior precedent of the Ninth Circuit of how is it not wrong to expose yourself for 30 to 40 seconds? How is it not wrong to
be... I appreciate the difference between tortious conduct and a constitutional violation, and you're doing a heck of a job of advocating for your client. But we're at the 12B6 stage. And is your best answer, because your time's ticking, is your best answer to Judge McEwen's question, right, about why not Vasquez, why didn't that put her on notice, is your best answer that it's a different, that the claim there was pled under a different amendment?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. I'm going to take that for an answer.
Yes.
And I'm guessing
I will
reserve
my remaining minute. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your patience with our questions. Good morning. At least I think it's still morning. Yes,
it is. Good morning. Good afternoon, maybe.
Not quite yet. Go ahead.
Okay. May it please the court, Chen Chen Jiang on behalf of plaintiff appellee T.W. The purpose of qualified immunity is to protect reasonable officials who make reasonable mistakes. and there was nothing reasonable about what Emily Etkenkamp did here. This court's precedent, as well as federal statute, the policies governing the juvenile facility where Etkenkamp worked, training materials, they all made crystal clear to the reasonable prison official, you cannot show a prisoner nude images of yourself. You cannot force them to watch homemade pornography of yourself masturbating. You cannot rub their leg in a sexual manner while asking them to have sex with you.
It's undisputed, because we're looking at the allegations in the complaint here, recognizing this person, I think, was 20 or 21 years old at the time that TW was.
Yes.
It's undisputed that those overtures were rebuffed.
That's correct.
Involuntary conduct.
Rebuffed by TW.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Okay. Under the Prison Rape Elimination Act, there's a requirement that this particular facility have implementing rules and policies in place. I don't see that our record includes the policies that were in place at the time. Do we have those?
It was cited in our briefing below, as well as referred to in the complaint.
I think what we have is a set that wasn't in place at the time. Seems to be dated more recently.
Ah, I see. Yes, that may have been our mistake in citing to the materials, but Your Honor is correct. There was a implementing policy that was in place at McLaren throughout the entirety.
Did Judge Mossman have that?
I'm not certain about that question,
okay,
Your Honor. It was cited and relied upon in the complaint, and it is public information, so it is certainly possible that Judge Mossman was able to look it up, because PREA as well as the juvenile facility policies were a topic of conversation below.
Was that an item of contention in the proceedings below, whether the regulation you cited was in place?
No, it was not, and we are not aware of any major changes that would have affected whether what Etkenkamp did here was or was not a violation of the policy. So I do not believe that, although we don't have that clarity on the record, that would have made a difference here.
The opposing counsel very candidly acknowledged when she first came to the podium that this behavior is very troubling on a moral level. There just about have to be professional ethical violations that were violated, and certainly employee rules, and on and on and on. And her point is there's a difference between all of that, any of that, and a constitutional violation, and whether her client was on notice. So could you speak to that? What's the best basis for the position that this constituted a constitutional violation of which Etkenkamp would have been aware?
The best basis is this court's case law and precedent. So starting with Swank, then continued in Wood, they made perfectly clear, as Your Honors recognize, sexual harassment or sexual abuse of any prisoner is unconstitutional. It violates the Eighth Amendment. Then in Bearchild in 2020, Bearchild actually specifically defined sexual assault and provided two concrete categories for what would qualify: touching in a sexual manner and other sexual conduct for the staff member's own sexual gratification. All those three cases together would have provided any reasonable official with clear notice that what Etkenkamp did here to TW was unconstitutional. Then we add in Vasquez, which is all on all fours with what Etkenkamp did here. It was also a juvenile facility. It was also grooming conduct. And in addition to that, it was sexual advances coupled with inappropriate comments and almost isolation, trying to get the youth to have sex with him. And Vasquez was particularly clear, it is always wrong for a juvenile facility officer to sexually harass or abuse a juvenile ward in this way. So that is the
Is he a juvenile ward at this point? Because you're suing under the Eighth Amendment, correct? He's 21 years old?
Yes, we're suing under the Eighth Amendment not because he's over 18, but because he happened to have been convicted as an adult.
When he
was 16. That's correct.
So you have cited these other cases, Bearchild, Wood, Vasquez, and we have this Supreme Court directive, as you're well aware of, Zorn v. Linton. You have to have a high degree of specificity with the right. So moving aside from those cases, I want to ask about a case you cited in your brief, Hope v. Pelzer. And there, that we talk about, it can be a rare case where the constitutional rule is identified and it's just obvious, with obvious clarity. How would that principle apply here, my first question? And second, that was a 2002 case. And does that change with the Supreme Court's later, what should I say, chipping away under 1983 as to the specificity of the right?
I'll address your first question first. Hope is directly applicable to this case here. And in our briefing below, we noted this is the obvious case. This is the case where the egregious sexual misconduct makes it so that all that's necessary here is to apply a general principle of law. And any reasonable officer would have known that, to know, no, you can't show homemade pornography to a prisoner in your care.
But Ron, notice that I agree with you. I think opposing counsel agrees with you, except there's a difference between can you do it, right, and is it tortious? It's going to be grounds for wrongful termination and so on and so forth. It's going to violate the rules, the policies. But there's a difference between that and violating the Constitution. What's your best argument there? Because there's a difference in the case law between Hope versus Peltzer, as Judge McEwen has called our attention to, and then the next 4 years that have expired since Hope.
Right, and we emphasize Hope and also Lanier, which Hope expanded upon, was never overturned by the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court did in the 20 years of ensuing case law is to clarify, that's the rare case, but it doesn't eliminate the possibility that there is an obvious case out there where the principles of law is enough. So we see that even in my colleague from the other side cited authority. White v. Pauley recognizes that the obvious case. D.C. v. Wesby also recognizes that there can be an obvious case. And I want to take a minute to address Zorn. Zorn also does not overturn what Hope stood for and Lanier stood for. What Zorn said was, the misconduct there is not an obvious case. That was the case involving a rear wrist lock tactic used on a protester. And so Zorn said in the facts of that case, the misconduct was not so clearly obvious that you can just take a general principle of law and apply it. That's different from what we have here. And in terms of the constitutional violation, the general principle is not just about what is reasonable or what is acceptable. The propositions stood for by Swank and Wood and Bearchild is that it is a violation of the Constitution, that this violates the Eighth Amendment. So it was quite clear it wasn't just a directive of what is or is not appropriate for an officer to engage in. It was fair warning and clear warning to prison officials everywhere in an adult prison or a juvenile facility. Hey, if you sexually harass or sexually abuse a prisoner, that is a violation of the Constitution.
Well, isn't there a big difference between sexual harassment and also assault, which would be a touching? And so in this case, ultimately, doesn't it depend on where on the leg was touched? What, for example, would happen if they had touched the toe?
I don't actually think it boils down at this stage, at the 12B6 stage, on whether it was a toe, a calf, the
right.
groin area.
I'm kind of looking down the road because
right.
you used the word sexual harassment, which
right.
is quite different.
Yes, and I do agree. If this was a case of mere verbal harassment, sexual harassment, jokes, words, then this would be a much, much harder case, especially on clearly established. But at this stage, the allegation is touching the leg in a sexual manner, and that's enough. Certainly, at least to warrant discovery and for the case to move on, particularly because that falls squarely into the first category of what Bearchild defined as sexual assault, not just sexual harassment. And then I also want to note, it's not just the touching of the leg that Etkenkamp engaged in. The complaint also alleged plenty of other sexual conduct, which is that second category of the definition of Bearchild of what constitutes sexual assault. So that's the showing of the lewd materials. That's the isolation. That's the asking multiple times for
right.
sex.
But I don't think any of our case law since Bearchild has had to engage in any conduct where there's allegedly I'll say sexual conduct short of touching. We haven't had to go there yet. Bear child, the definition of bear child allows for it, I guess is what I would say. But of course, the conduct at issue in bear child was all about touching. One incident, not the grooming touching that you've, or grooming behavior that you've described. I just want to shift gears a little bit because your time is ticking down. And if we go back, one way of looking at that, this is, as opposing counsel has urged us to look for a case, you know, on all fours, including, you know, which amendment was pled in a previous case. But if we go back to what is the purpose of qualified immunity and cite the Supreme Court authority, I think they've consistently said that the purpose is to make sure that people can go about their jobs and not have to look over their shoulders and second guess at every step. Are they doing their jobs correctly? Because they have to have some freedom, you know, to do that. They can be wrong. They can't be unreasonable. The Supreme Court has told us that over and over again. And it seems to me that's why these many facts that you've mentioned, you know, matter a lot, particularly the fact that this person was in a therapeutic relationship. Opposing counsel's brief argues that the court, Judge Mossman, erred by considering that she was in a therapeutic relationship. And I'm trying to figure out how you think that role, because she wasn't a prison guard, she was a therapist working in a detention facility. How does that factor into the analysis, please?
I think the fact that she was a mental health counselor aggravates the misconduct, especially when we're talking about the objective prong of the Eighth Amendment violation, and that looks at what is morally repugnant to the conscience of mankind. Knowing that Etkenkamp was a mental health counselor, and I believe Your Honors raised it in previous discussions with opposing counsel, not just a mental health counselor, but one who was tasked to be on a sexual assault response team to support TW because he had already been previously victimized by another staff for sexual abuse. I think that's the context that Judge Mossman correctly considered in determining that this is the type of conduct that rises to an Eighth Amendment violation. And so we believe the fact that she was a mental health counselor helps establish why this is a viable Eighth Amendment claim. And in terms of the—
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I want to hear opposing counsel's response to this. I think that's right. So you'll have an opportunity to respond. The reason I think it's right is because I don't think this is a case where this individual, certainly at the 12B6 level, where we'd be concerned that she was going to be in a position where she'd have to look over her shoulder and didn't know how to do her job. That's why, that's the gist of it for me. And I think you've answered the question, but I wanted to make sure we have that on the record so opposing counsel can respond.
I agree, Your Honor. Where when we see qualified immunity get invoked, especially in the Eighth Amendment context, is when often there are exigent circumstances. So, for example, Hudson dealt with a prison riot where we recognize that's a challenging job and you're under pressure. You need to make split-second decisions. That's not present here. Also not present here is that the sexual misconduct is not even tangentially involved or related to a legitimate prison guard role. So some of these cases may have started out with a pat-down or a cell search.
Like Bear Child.
Like Bear Child. And so the question there is, where was the scope of the permissible act exceeded? We don't have that here either. There is no allegation that any of the sexual misconduct had any legitimate penological justification. So I do think
the job. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So I do think that makes this case the obvious case where any reasonable official would have known you cannot make sexual advances, both physical and verbal, and execute on that targeted campaign of grooming.
Counsel, you're just about out of time. I just have one question. You're now talking about our follow-up. We've led you down this path about hope. And those cases. I just want to make sure you're also of the view, because I understood from your briefing, you're of the view that our own case law, including Bear Child, put her on notice. So in other words, that this conduct, as alleged in the complaint, accepting it as true at the moment, at this stage, would violate or to trigger the definition in Bear Child. Do I misunderstand your position?
No, I think Your Honor is asking, even putting the general principle aside.
Yeah, put aside the obvious case example.
Yes.
And then is it your position that this triggers the Bear Child definition?
Absolutely. Bear Child, as well as, you know, we're looking at the state of the law in general. So that includes the federal regulations, PREA, the juvenile policies, as well as the training materials and the other authorities that were cited in our briefing.
Are there more questions? No. I don't think we have any other questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. We ask that the district court be affirmed.
Right. I will try to be brief within my 1 minute remaining. I wanted to start off by pulling everyone back into there's actually a presumption of qualified immunity, and it's the plaintiff's burden to establish why qualified immunity does not exist. So I want to, again, just frame that framework here. And one of those burdens is, in addition to having to state the violation of the Eighth Amendment, to actually identify what specific case involving similar factual circumstances as what was alleged here clearly established an Eighth Amendment violation. One of the issues that opposing counsel had referred to was looking to the state of the law, including policies, rules, PREA, in terms of whether Ektenkamp was on notice. That is actually incorrect. Davis, the Supreme Court case, as well as Ninth Circuit cases, including, I believe, the Case case, established that you, just because there is a violation of a policy or a rule or a statute, does not equate to being clearly established for Eighth Amendment purposes. And then the final issue I'll conclude with is with respect to why Wood and Bear Child are not enough here, of looking at that language of touching in a sexual manner, and whether there was a mental health counselor involved or not. If the court were to say that that was enough, that would effectively, whether it was reduce or even eliminate qualified immunity, particularly at the beginning of a case, simply because an inmate were to allege there had been a touch and that they allege it was in a sexual manner.
Counsel, you're over your time.
Thank you very much.
And you've been very patient with our questions, both of you. Thank you very much. We're going to take this case under advisement, and we'll get you a decision just as soon as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
I think both counsel were very helpful to us in illuminating, and I do want to thank you, Ms. Swift, for acknowledging upfront.
Yes.
The sensitive and difficult nature of the case. So appreciate that.
Yes,
thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
We'll stand.
All rise.